It's Elizabeth McGann, the Holistic GLP-1 Podcast.
The way in which I look at GLP-1s in this sense is it actually helps you have a window. And the window is, what happens when I am not thinking about food? What happens when I'm not coping with food, alcohol, or any other substances to deal with these specific emotional blockages that I have been dealing with? And when we get rid of these specific things that we're using as coping mechanisms, we come to awareness and we come to truth.
Hey, it's your friend Elizabeth, and welcome back to the Holistic GLP-1 Podcast. Thanks for being in our community. It's an honor to spend this time with you, and I'm so excited for you to hear today's conversation. If you're considering a GLP-1 and want to approach it holistically, or you're already taking one and thinking, how do I get the very best result from this? This episode is for you, because here's what I want you to consider. The GLP-1 is only one part of the equation. It can quiet food noise, reduce appetite, and make losing weight feel possible again. But what if that's only the beginning? What if this period when food suddenly has less power over you is actually an incredible window of opportunity? An opportunity to strengthen your body, change your relationship with food, understand what's underneath your eating, and ultimately become the woman who can sustain the transformation you're creating. And that's where today's guest, Dan Goh, comes in. Dan is the performance coach to high performers. He and his team have helped their clients lose more than 100,000 pounds. But here's why I really wanted to bring Dan to you. After more than two decades of doing this work, Dan believes lasting change isn't just about food, exercise, or even losing weight. It's about who you become as you go through this journey. And he said something during our conversation that I haven't stopped thinking about. Weight loss is a spiritual process disguised as a physical one. We ask the question, what are you really hungry for? And then we go somewhere most GLP-1 conversations don't go, into the emotional, energetic, and spiritual work underneath the weight. Because ultimately, this conversation isn't only about the weight you're ready to lose. It's about what you're ready to let go of. And before we jump in, I have something exciting to share with you. My brand new free masterclass, How to Microdose a GLP-1 Holistically, is officially available now. You'll find it in the show notes. Inside, I walk you step by step through my body, mind, and soul approach to microdosing a GLP-1, including how to support your body's own natural GLP-1 production and how to successfully come off the microdose once you reach your goal weight. And here's what's so powerful. With this method, the microdose itself is truly optional. Again, you'll find the link in the show notes. And I think today's conversation with Dan is such a beautiful companion to that free masterclass, because both are ultimately asking a bigger question. How do we use this opportunity not just to lose weight, but to change our lives? I already know you're going to think of someone while you're listening today, a friend, a sister, someone you love that wants a better way to approach a GLP-1. Send her this episode, because I think you're both going to walk away thinking differently about what this journey can actually be. So without further ado, please help me welcome the extraordinary Dan Goh to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, gosh. It's so cool to have you here. And I want to dive right in. Our listeners, who are mostly women, you know, 40s and above, sometimes a little bit younger, kind of that perimenopause, menopause swing, I like to call it. And they're interested in doing GLP-1s the right way. Mm-hmm. And if someone were listening today and they really took to heart what you're going to teach us about why weight loss is so much more than just a physical process, and how a GLP-1 might fit into that journey, how might it transform her life?
The way in which I look at transformation, and I've been doing this for the past 20 years, and I actually got into this because I experienced the benefits from getting my own body in shape. And I like to say that transformation, especially health transformation, is a spiritual process that is disguised as a physical one.
Woo!
Yes. Yes. Everyone thinks that they're getting into it to weigh a little bit less on the scale, to look a little bit better in the mirror. But the thing I realized as we're getting ourselves to this outcome of being in better shape is that we will find out so many things about ourselves that we would not be privy to if we had not gone through this process. Things that I've experienced coaching thousands of clients over the past 20 years, I've seen people get out of really bad relationships. I've seen people get out of jobs that they absolutely hated, all because they made these realizations about themselves. And it's almost like as they had lost weight, they'd gone through these crises and these obstacles, but these were not necessarily crises or obstacles. They were actually communications from their own spirit telling them something so many times, and they were just ignoring it until the point where they had clarity. After they start to do all the healthy things, like after they start to exercise, after they start to lose weight, after they start to really clean up their diet and really fix their sleep, then they will have the container of which to be able to see these realizations. I always say that we're getting these communications from ourselves, you know, constantly. We can call it the gut, we can call it intuition. And a lot of times we just ignore them or we don't even hear them whatsoever because of what's going on with our bodies, what's going on with our brains, and anything that is going on with our bodies are inextricably going to be linked to what is happening with our brains. And the way in which I look at GLP-1s in this sense is it actually helps you have a window. And the window is, what happens when I am not thinking about food? What happens when I'm not coping with food, alcohol, or any other substances to deal with these specific emotional blockages that I have been dealing with? And when we get rid of these specific things that we're using as coping mechanisms, we come to awareness and we come to truth. And I've actually found with a good amount of people who are on these GLP-1s, they are making incredible mental health strides, not just physical strides, but mental health strides, because they have a greater awareness of themselves, why they do certain things. It's almost like they have this space between the stimulus and response. Ooh. And then when, yeah, and then when they learn this, and when they learn more about themselves, it gives them more ammo. It actually gives them the opportunity to change their identity, to be able to evolve.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, you are just dropping some truth bombs. So we're going to, we just need to unpack some of this, Dan. thank you for this. So this is fantastic. So let's talk about this.
Like we do it. Want to know how to microdose a GLP-1 holistically? My free masterclass walks you through it step by step, including how to stimulate your body's own GLP-1 naturally and how to come off the microdose once you reach your goal weight. And here's the best part. With this method, the microdose itself is truly optional. Click the link in the show notes to watch it free. And if you'd like more personalized support, you can apply for a free holistic GLP-1 microdosing blueprint call with me. We'll look at where you are now, what's possible for you, and the safest healing path to get there.
Like we do it.
You're pointing to this as a window. You call it a window of opportunity. And I love that. And I want to know more what you mean about that. But let's come back to that in just one moment. You said it's a spiritual process, a psychological process. And I heard you say one time that you can't change your body without changing your mind. Yeah. And we'll even go so far as part of the mind might even be your energy, your spirit. Tell me more about what you mean by that.
So when most people try to lose weight, they focus on the external things. So they focus on, okay, so what kind of diet should I do? What kind of weight do I want to be at? They focus on, okay, what kind of workout should I do? And they're so focused on these kind of external outcomes and these tasks to do. They never ask themselves, like, who am I actually becoming as a result of doing these things? Because like the person that they are becoming is way more important than the tasks they are doing, because everything that comes downstream from the actions that they take is actually coming from the person they are. And willpower can only last for so long. So when people start a journey into weight loss, they're using a lot of discipline, they're using a lot of willpower. And when they're doing this, they are almost extracting energy from that process, as opposed to asking themselves, well, if weight loss were relevant and I didn't have to worry about this problem anymore, who would I have to become as a person in order to make this happen?
Who would I have to become as a person to make that happen? That is profound.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do research. And like for me, I actually say this, and some people have taken offense to this, where I'm like, losing weight's the easy part. Come on. Like, everyone's lost weight. Everyone's like lost 20, 30 pounds off their bodies. And guess what happens? They just put it back on, right? Mm. The sustainability of that weight loss, the ability to lose weight and keep it off, is much like the person who is able to make money and be able to keep that money. That is like the true crux of what we're after. How do we get there? We get there through identity change. We get there through not having to exercise in order to lose more weight. We get there through having to exercise because we actually love exercising and it makes us feel better. We get there through making sure that we're monitoring and keeping track and keeping ourselves honest with specific numbers. We're not trying to shy away from them. We are tracking these numbers, like whether it be their weight, their blood work, whatever it is. It's just like being honest about it. We're adopting a diet that is actually sustainable. It's not one that is like, oh, you gotta go carnivore, or you gotta like cut all carbs. I actually say this. It's like, actually, I find that GLP-1s give us an opportunity to be able to eat the foods that we need to eat, but also to be able to allow the foods that help us enjoy life in moderate ways that will make the diet way more sustainable in the end. And actually, I remember, a prominent health influencer came out and he was just like, you know what, guys? I finally did it. I have the perfect diet right now. I'm eating at the perfect times. I'm eating the perfect foods. And then I, like in my brain, I was just like, this is from the evidence that we have. This is actually the beginning portions of someone creating an almost like an eating disorder for themselves when they're trying everything to be making everything perfect. If anything I know about like lifestyle, especially like keeping the weight off, it's that you should not have a perfect diet, actually. You should aim for an imperfect diet and to allow the things that you want to have in moderation. So it really is not about doing. It actually is about becoming. And then when you, it's kind of like the old adage where someone says, oh, I can't smoke, to someone that says, I don't smoke. And then that is the place of which we're where we want to go to.
Oh, gosh. Brilliant. So changing your identity to someone who, from what to what? So if someone's really stuck in, I struggle with my weight. A lot of the women that I work with have been maybe dieting their whole lives. They have maybe the genetics that have prevented them from, you know, they can eat like their friends and their friends stay slim and they gain weight. And it's just, and it's once they hit perimenopause and menopause, what used to work no longer works. So they've had a history of it being harder. That's become an identity. Then they may have a history of it being, now I'm much older and my body just won't do it anymore. If they're up against something, which you know, we could say some people have an easier time losing weight than others. If that's been part of their identity, I'm someone where this, it's hard. Weight loss doesn't work for me. How do they change that identity? They know they have to. It would be a good idea, but how do they do that?
The very first thing I would look at is always someone's vocabulary and the things that they say to themselves. Words are, to me, the most magical things on the planet. And there's a reason why they call it spelling, because like the more that we say these things over and over and over to ourselves and to people, you know, people who are helping them, what they're doing is they're casting a spell upon themselves of driving down this belief. And I just like to ask anyone who says that, is there someone in your position who has the exact same circumstances, the exact same resources? Have they been able to make positive changes, the ones that you're trying to make right now? The answer is always going to be 100% yes. So it always goes back to the way in which people are perceiving themselves, the way in which people are perceiving the problems, and how those two things connect. So I will always look at their vocabulary. The very first thing I would say is to, if you want to actually be a different person, you actually have to change the way in which you think and the things that come out of your mouth in the first place. And it may seem a little bit weird at first because you're doing something that's counter to the way in which you've been hypnotizing yourself for however long, the past couple of years. But we have to understand that, hey, if someone else has been able to make this identity change, then I can make this identity change as well. And a lot of times when people say these things to themselves, they are essentially lying to themselves, but using rationalizations and excuses. So when someone says to them, I just don't have the genetics to do it and whatever, and we get their DNA, put it up against a microscope, it'll be like, actually, you have pretty average genetics. When we look at the idea of like, I just have a slow metabolism, when we do the research and we look at the evidence, we're looking at, it's actually around like 60 to 65 years old, like when your metabolism actually starts to see these changes, especially if you haven't been like weight training at all. So a lot of times when people are doing this, they're reinforcing the story that allows them to stay stuck where they are. So the very first thing I would look at is the vocabulary. There's actually one more thing I would look at as well, which is how do they see themselves inside of their own minds? And this is an example where I was working with a client. We had helped her lose 30 pounds off her body. She was looking completely different. She was a completely different person, top to bottom. But every time that she looked in the mirror, she was like, she actually thought she was getting fatter, which is absolutely ridiculous. But it happens to a lot of people. It happens to a lot of people who are trying to lose weight because the brain actually takes a little bit of time to catch up to the body in terms of the changes they're making. There's a lot of reasons why you have your clients saying like, my friend said that, it looks like I'm losing weight. I don't see it at all. Like, I don't see it. So what I'm getting to is the fact that they have this like self-image, this picture of themselves that's in their minds of like who they are. And that is their reality. So even if they lose 30, 40, 50 pounds off their bodies, they look in the mirror, they may see the exact same person staring back at them. So we have to change that picture in their minds, and we have to replace it with one that is not only more realistic, but one that is more in line with the person that they are essentially becoming.
Yeah. And they need to listen to their thoughts. They need to listen to the words they say. Yeah. And can they start saying things like, would it sound like, this will work for me? This can work for me.
It worked for anyone else?
I see.
Yeah. I actually like to combine this one specific exercise with someone who is trying to lose weight. And this one specific exercise is going to sound so simple, but please do not dismiss this, which is every single day, all you're going to do is you're just going to write a couple of lines of the things that you have done and the things that you have experienced as a result of doing this journey, whether it be weight loss for a GLP-1 or whether it be weight loss without a GLP-1. And the reason why we want to do that is because it brings self-awareness. Let's just say that people are dealing with, let's just say addictions to certain things, foods, alcohol, whatever it is. And what they lack is the reasons why they actually do what they do. So when we're taking this daily journal, and I've actually done this so many times, like anytime that I've tried to change a specific thing that I didn't like in my life, I always combine that with a habit of just like daily journaling, like what are my thoughts? What are my feelings? What am I experiencing? What am I aware of? And then just having awareness of like our operating system by writing to ourselves, that's going to change so much downstream, because when we go into these like coping mechanisms, whether it's like food, alcohol, or whatever, we actually have this repository of all these experiences that we have outlined, and we'll be like, actually this is actually why I do what I do. This is actually the reason. And I'll use myself as an example.
Yes.
Where I used to have a horrible habit of when I had dinner. After, like, actually, I could control the way I eat for the vast majority of the day and also the vast majority of the weekend or the week. But when it came to dinner and when it came to, like, Friday, it's like all bets were off. It's like nighttime eating. It's like the ends of the day just became – the ends of the day and the ends of the week just became horrible.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, cool. Like, the symptom is me overeating, especially at the end of the day. Let's just call it that. Where exactly does this come from? And I like to use this process called like the five whys, which is like you keep on asking yourself why, even though you answer a question, you keep on asking yourself why as if you're trying to peel an onion and get deeper to the core. So I asked myself these five whys. So I was like, why do I eat at night? Oh, I eat at night because I'm stressed. Okay, so why do you end up eating your stress? I eat up eating my stress because it just like makes me feel good. It actually makes me feel like I forget the stress for a specific period of time. cool, like where, or actually I don't use why, but it's like, where do you think you learned that from? And actually for me, I went through this process and I journaled it out. And when I came down all the way to the beginnings of this particular habit, I remember, so I came from I love my family, but came from like a very like a dysfunctional family. Everyone's kind of like, you know, racking their heads and, you know, ramming their heads against each other. And I got, let's just say, anxious and very stressed from those specific way in which I was living. So when I would, when everyone's going to sleep at 10 p.m. at night, I would actually just go down to the kitchen and I would open the fridge and open the pantry. And I would actually like, if it was in the fridge and my mom created this like, you know, stew and everything was like coagulated, I would actually go in and just eat everything that was like coagulated. It was like, it was almost disgusting. Mm. I would go in, I would just basically eat until I could not feel anymore. And then when I opened that up and when I became privy to that particular experience, what happened was, as a result of that, was number one, I understood why I was doing a certain habit and behavior. Number two is I could actually do stuff to start to heal that part of my life. Once you're aware of the cause and the root cause of a specific problem, especially when it's emotional, the thing is that you don't go into coping mechanisms to hope that you don't feel this emotion anymore. You actually go into the root cause and to start to make sense of like why you did what you did and to start to heal those specific parts in those specific areas. And I'm not going to say that I'm perfect, but you know, ever since I figured that out, like 6 p.m. hits, I don't eat anymore. I don't want to eat. I know the reasons why. And it's just one of these things where I brought that into my life and I don't have to think about weight loss anymore because I've fixed the number one bottleneck that actually prevented me from losing weight in the first place.
Oh, I love that. And the journaling and asking yourself the questions of why, and maybe even, you know, as you're reaching for the thing in the refrigerator, whatever it is, what am I really hungry for?
Yeah.
What am I really hungry for?
I like to also ask the question, it's like, what am I trying to escape?
Mm.
Yeah. What am I trying to numb with this thing that I'm doing?
Numbing and dumbing. And, you know, whether that's stress or loneliness or boredom or, you know, whatever it is, when you figure it out, it's part of healing the root cause and you can find a more productive way to meet that need. In Overeaters Anonymous, you may be familiar with an addiction recovery, hungry, halt. Hungry, am I hungry? Halt. Mm. Angry, A-L, lonely, tired. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And running through that, it's, if you're, it can fix it, not just with the food.
Yeah, I do this, I do this a lot. So I've created this like, this AI coach specifically trained towards me.
Hey.
And I do this thing with my AI coach, which is urge surfing.
Ooh.
So when I have this craving, and I'll use myself as an example again. So I was out to date night with my wife, and we shared a drink with each other. That's what we do. Like, we share a drink with each other. And then I had this craving to be like, hey, I think I want like a second old fashioned. I think I want that. And I know in my mind, I know that when I have the second old fashioned, that's going to be almost like opening up the floodgates to being like, all right, order the calamari, get the fries. And like all this, it just like takes my inhibitions and just like, just ruins it. So I ended up telling my coach, and it actually took me through a couple of questions to understand why I was feeling this. And then all it did was just, hey, how do you feel about just giving this like 15 minutes?
Okay.
15 minutes, you don't have to do anything. You can have the drink after 15 minutes if you still want it. Mm. You know the reason why you're reaching for it. So are you okay with just giving yourself like 15 minutes? We can start a timer right now. And then you could say you give yourself permission to have the second old fashioned after the 15 minutes if you still want it.
Yeah.
So after the 15 minutes was done, I was like, you know what? Like, it gives you that pause between stimulus and response.
Ooh, that's so, you said that at the top of the this conversation.
Yeah.
The pause, the between stimulus and response.
Yeah. Yeah.
Power of the pause. Can you just tell us a little bit more about why that works so well?
So what happens when we feel the urge to do something that we know is not going to quell our hunger. We know it's not necessarily something we would do that is in line with, you know, the person that we're becoming. And a lot of the times what happens is we just react. So if we want that food, we're going to go get that food. We're going to eat that food. And then what happens when we do that is we just give into that very short-term urge that probably was there for probably 5 minutes, and then after a while, it just goes away. When we give ourselves this pause between stimulus and response, what happens is that you allow different parts of your brain to come in and just to talk with you. It's like, hey, do you really want that old-fashioned? Are you really sure you want that? And also, you give yourself time to also just, how do I say this? Like, chill out your nervous system.
Yes.
Because what's happening with that craving, it's like you're having that craving most times, not because you're craving the actual food, but because like something is coming up inside of you that causes you to want to go reach for this thing. So as long as you give yourself this pause to do a couple of things, you can actually just pause, give yourself time, or you can do what David Hawkins does in his book, Letting Go, which is to allow yourself to, whoa.
Holding up the Letting Go book, ladies and gentlemen, if you're just
holy.
This. Yes, this book, we're gonna get into it. We're aligned, whoa. Dan, you and I.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Aligned. Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay. I love serendipity.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite things. So going to the book,
yeah.
We can allow ourselves to take that time to fully feel the emotion that is happening inside of us. And when I say fully feel the emotion, if people are actually listening to this or even watching it, let's just say you sit with yourself and you pinpoint where that emotion is in your body. For some people, it could be their stomach. For some people, it could be their chest, their solar plexus, their throat. And just to pinpoint where that is. And then when you're doing that, you're not trying to get rid of it. That's actually the thing that actually makes it come back. What you're trying to do is you're actually trying to not necessarily stop it. You're actually trying to go through it by allowing it to feel fully through you. So when I pinpoint where that emotion is, I'm able to sit with it. I'm able to get curious about it. I'm able to feel what it feels like in my body. Sometimes, like when I'm doing this, I can sometimes feel like I need to throw up. Sometimes, like, it actually makes me like queasy to allow this emotion to go through me. But what happens is that we have all these emotions that are inside of us that a lot of us kind of just do certain things to not feel and to push back. What happens as a result is it's almost like a dam, and the dam is going to break, and the dam breaks in many different ways, shapes, and forms. It could be food, alcohol intake. It could be like fighting with your spouse and just like, you know, it could be anything. But allowing yourselves to let the emotion be felt and to give it the time that it needs to pass through us, what happens is, number one, whatever craving that we had is probably like 70%, 80% almost gone. We have enough presence of mind to be able to deal with it. The second thing is, we have actually dealt with the emotion in one of the healthiest ways possible. Mm. And one of the most effective ways in order to actually not feel the emotion is to actually allow ourselves to feel it fully. And that's what the letting go process is.
Yeah. And I want to get deeper into the letting go process by David Hawkins, The Pathway to Surrender. It was interesting. I was referencing it the other day in a client session, and I just happened to open on a page where it basically said, where David Hawkins was positing that most people are so afraid to deal with their emotions because they don't have a tool that can effectively help that works well enough to move it through them. And so they're afraid, essentially. And that was certainly my story. So when you do have an effective tool, when you're like, you know what, no matter what emotion is coming up, no matter what I'm feeling, you know, so many people with food addiction or any addiction are afraid of feeling. But if you can say to yourself, I don't need to be afraid of this. And I have a tool. I'm curious what a good tool would be. And maybe we can talk a little bit about what you use and maybe even how it ties back to this amazing book. But I like to think of it as a feeling fully felt can leave, can dissipate.
Yes. Yes. And as kids, you know, we've been on this earth for quite a long time, but we were never taught about emotional regulation and emotional management. we were like, emotions are such a huge part of our lives. Everyone feels it, or at least I would hope everyone feels it, unless someone's like a sociopath. And, you know, maybe they need different help. But yeah, but we all feel
that's
emotions. But
podcast.
We, yeah, but I mean, like our generation. I don't know about your generation of parents, but like my generation of parents, Asian parents, immigrated, came to Canada. I mean, we didn't have time for this emotional mumbo jumbo. Like we didn't have any time for that. Yeah. We were never taught how to manage our emotions. We actually were latchkey kids. We're four kids in a house living together while our parents were working till like midnight, sometimes like 24 hours a day at the printing shop. So I was like in the Lord of the Flies situation, just like trying to figure things out as the youngest kid inside of my house. And that we were never taught about tools or even having any tools for emotional regulation. And the thing about the letting go process and the thing about, say, like journaling is at least you have a tool as opposed to zero tools. It's kind of like you're trying to put up a picture and you only have a hammer. Well, thank goodness you have a hammer. What if you didn't have anything? Like, what if you didn't have any tools whatsoever? So having a tool or having a set of tools is better than having no tools. And I feel like these are kind of like these tools in our toolbox when it comes to emotional regulation that we are not taught as children, but we are learning later on in life from amazing books like Letting Go.
Yeah. And all the tools that you have, and I want to hear more about your work, and we're going to get into that in a minute. You have like a high performance GLP-1 process, which is so interesting. But let's hang out in the spiritual dimension for just a moment, because, you know, a lot of people and might, when they first think about weight loss, they may not immediately associate it with a spiritual process. And that spiritual, sometimes that word can mean different things to different people. We're not necessarily talking about religion, although I'm sure that could overlay. It's that kind of energetic, that deepest beat, consciousness, mindfulness, whatever that is for you. But a lot of times people don't necessarily think that getting the body they want is a spiritual process. Hawkins, I think, I don't know if he's said this, but when I was reading the book, he does talk a lot about, Hawkins being the author of Letting Go that we're talking about. He talks about that it could be stored pain, an accumulation of hurts, of pain that all of a sudden becomes a heaviness in that invisible heaviness that then manifests physically as weight. What are your thoughts on that?
Going back to what we were talking about previously, where people would say to you, they would say, I don't have the best genetics. It's not for me. And I don't have I have a slow metabolism. And like all these like rationalizations, I always like to ask people, where do you think you got that from? Probably wasn't from you. Everyone likes to be like, think that they're the owners of their own thoughts, when the reality is that we collect thoughts from the people around us, whether it be from childhood or whether it be from our parents and what they repeat to us, whether it be from our friends, coworkers. I mean, there are so many influences around. Social media is a massive one, obviously. And I like to ask them, like, where do you think you got this from? And then they'll be like, oh, these are my own thoughts. Like, no, like, are you sure? Like, you've adopted this, it's either coming from someone else or coming from a way in which you reacted to a situation that became your worldview over the course of time. I just want people to be aware. I mean, like, one of the things in which to be able to, kind of rewire their brains around this is to list out the competing beliefs that they have about the goal that they're trying to set for themselves or the person they're trying to become. So if they have the belief of, I don't have the genetics to get my body in shape, write that down. And then write it all out. Write out all these beliefs that would hold you back. And then just the simple act of writing them down, it gives you self-awareness. And then you can just ask yourself, where did this come from? Where did I believe this? Is there a chance that I can change this belief? And then something I like to do as a follow-up exercise to that is like, okay, so what exactly is the belief that you would like to adopt over the course of the next like 10 to 20 years? That is the antithesis to the thing that you wrote. And then a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of things to be said about, you know, these things like affirmations and whatever, and I get it. But the very first way of like just hypnotizing ourselves into the person we want to become is by changing our beliefs and our vocabulary. It doesn't mean to eschew any reality. It doesn't mean to like just say like, oh, I'm like, I have a six pack right now when they're like, you know, severely overweight. But it does mean that we are gaining this awareness around the specific things that actually hold us back, that actually cause the actions that we are taking, to get awareness around them and to create these new beliefs and to give ourselves pause to create these new beliefs about the person we know that we can become. I like to also say it's like you have to give yourself the light at the end of the tunnel as well. And what I mean by this is like, do you think that you can change? Do you have the belief that you can actually do this? And a lot of people will be, yeah, I do. Okay, prove it to me. Why do you believe this? Why do you want this in your life? What models do you have inside of your life that prove this belief to be true? And I'm pretty sure, and that's actually like a little bit of a harder thought exercise for a lot of people because everyone's so focused on kind of like the things that aren't going right as opposed to the things that are working for like other people. It's very much like a survivor-based mentality. But the more that we can give ourselves these examples of things that work and things that have worked for others and things that are possible for us and give ourselves a light at the end of the tunnel to say that we can make these changes, that opens up so many things. It actually just opens up the idea that you can actually change this part of your life. And I remember when I was, it wasn't like I was trying to lose, actually when I was trying to lose weight and I was like, as out of shape as possible as when I was in my 20s. And I looked at myself in the mirror. I'm like, I can't see anything else but this. The thing I asked myself is, has anyone else done this? Like, has anyone else in my position been able to do this? And obviously, like, we didn't have social media back then. So, I mean, back in my 20s, like, we didn't have any Instagram, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff. But I just knew it's like, yeah, there have been people through reading Men's Fitness and Men's Health. And like, I got examples, but there are people out there who have made this change. And if they can make the change, then I can too. And at least that gave me the light at the end of the tunnel to believe that I could do this.
Yeah, if someone can do it, it means you can do it as well. There's a map, so to speak. And I know you work with a lot of high performers, and I would love to even define high performance. What does that mean, high performers? And how could someone who maybe doesn't even identify necessarily with, oh, maybe I'm not a high performer. We do work with a lot of very successful people. That said, if someone's listening to this and they're like, maybe I'm not a high performer, maybe I just don't have what it takes. What is high performance and how could someone create that identity of being someone that can make it happen?
I've never actually been asked this question before.
You're in the hot seat.
I am.
You can do it.
Absolutely. So I believe the concept that people have in terms of high performance is they're looking at Usain Bolt and you're looking at all these professional athletes and they're like, I can never be that. Or they're looking at entrepreneurs like Jeff Bezos, looking at guys that are, you know, have multi-billion, trillion-dollar businesses. They're like, I don't think. To me, high performance is a person who is willing to do what it takes to reach their full potential, whether that's them being the best mom that they can be, whether that's them being the best executive they can be, whether that's them being the best Etsy creator that they can, like, whatever it is, like, we all have these desires for growth, and whichever way in which you want to put that energy and advance and keep on growing, that to me is a high performer. And a lot of people, they kind of like just do everything else that everyone else does and they just want to like toe the average. Like, to me, the high performer is someone that actually goes after the thing that they want, even if it means no logical sense to anyone else around them.
Yeah.
So these are people that just,
to do whatever it takes.
Yes.
There's someone that's like, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. And if there's someone out there that has gotten the result that I want, that means I can get it too.
Absolutely. It's more of mentality than anything else.
Yeah. And, you know, body, we talk a lot here about body, mind, soul, like getting your mind right, getting your energy right, getting all of that into alignment, you know, and what I'm hearing you say that a lot of getting your mind right is that identity, that belief that it's possible.
Yes.
And the body can follow.
Yes. It's first of all, it has to come from the mind. So that's the very first thing. Your mind has to have the possibility that this can be a reality in your life. If your mind does not have that possibility that this can be a reality in your life, then everything that you do is going to be held back by what the mind believes it can do. So that's like the very first thing. The second thing is also thinking back to, okay, well, what if I didn't have to deal with this problem ever again? What kind of person would I have to become? A lot of times when we think about this stuff, they're like, okay, well, I want to lose 30 pounds and I want to fit into this size dress and I want to do this. And that's all cool. That's awesome. But no, it's like when you wake up in the morning, what are the first thoughts that come out of your brain? When you look at yourself in the mirror, what is the conversation that's going on in your mind? Is the conversation like looking at all the spots that are imperfect and being like, oh, I don't like this and I don't like that? Or are you looking at it being like, I am so grateful that I have a body that is my vehicle to go through life with. I'm so grateful that I have arms and I have my legs and my arms are working, my legs are working, like my eyes, my ears can hear all this kind of stuff. Like it is the appreciation for what their bodies can do, as opposed to looking at the parts of their bodies that aren't necessarily up to standard for what they want. And then it's the vocabulary. It's the conversation they're having with themselves. It's always going to go back to that. And I like to ask, if you were talking to your best friend and you were saying the things that you're saying to yourself to your best friend, how would you still have a friend at the end of that conversation? Like if you are constantly putting down your body, if you are constantly insulting it, if you're talking down to it, if you're expressing the lack of hope and more despair, and if your best friend, which is you, we're all our own, we all have to be our own best friends. If you were to tell this to your best friend, would they still be your best friend? And if that answer is no, then you have to go into being like, okay, well, how would I talk to my best friend? What kind of conversation would I have if my best friend came up to me and said, hey, look at this? I would hope that the conversation would be a lot different. And then that's the mental model that I would like people to have when they start to go on the process of getting themselves in shape. And the reason why I would like to start there as opposed to, I mean, we do start with like, okay, well, here's your case. Like you have to track your this and you have to do your workouts, this workout, you have to do this diet, blah, blah, blah. We go through the tactical stuff, but the most important thing is going to be, who are you at the end of this? And who are you becoming at the end of this?
Yeah.
And how does that person talk? What are their beliefs? And what are the persistent thoughts that go through their minds as they're going through life?
So powerful. So, wow, that there's so much there. So what would be an identity if someone really is at the heart of their like, okay, I got this. I realize that my identity, I'm identified with someone who has a hard time with, I don't like to exercise. I'm a fat person. I'm a big person. I live in a big body. I am obese. I have the disease of obesity. This isn't going to work. They realize that those are the thoughts that have been circulating through their mind for a long time. And perhaps they have a lot of evidence as well.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
What is the new identity? What would that even sound like?
Yeah. So we go through the aspect of writing down the beliefs that they currently have.
Mm-hmm.
The new identity is going to be the antithesis to those specific beliefs that held them back.
Okay.
So if they're a person that says like, I hate working out, I don't like exercising, that belief can turn into, I choose a form of exercise that I enjoy. And I love doing that. I love doing that specific exercise. If they're like, I can't stick to a diet. I don't want to like do keto. I don't want to cut carbs. I don't want to do any of this stuff. Then what is the antithesis to that? It's, I treat my body and I feed myself as if it was like a person I loved.
Yeah.
So we go into these statements that become a form of their identity. And then afterwards, what we want to do is we want to be able to just give ourselves a different mental image that's going on in our minds, to give ourselves like, just like for a few slides, Like, what exactly do you look like in this idealized version that you are becoming? And I remember there was like this one time where I had gone through several like failed relationships. As I went through these relationships, I remember I was in New York. I got dropped off at a Pret-a-Manger and I was like, okay, well, I'm sick of this. What kind of person would I like to attract in my life? I wrote 10 of those things down. None of it had anything to do with like aesthetics or cosmetics or anything like that. But the most important list was like, who do I have to become in order to attract this person into my life?
Oh, I like that.
Yes. So think about it this way. Make a list. Make a list of like, okay, so what exactly is that idealized version of yourself? And get as exact as you can. So what weight is that, or what range of weight? What is the dress size? What do you see in the mirror every time you look at yourself? And then afterwards, write the separate list of like, okay, well, now who exactly do I have to become in order to achieve that? What kind of beliefs and thoughts do I have to have in my mind that would lead me to the actions to achieving that? And then the last part that I would put is to give yourself a long time horizon. So a lot of times when people do this stuff and they're like, okay, transform in 4 weeks and 28 days. I was like, honey, I wish I could just tell you that would be true. But we're looking at this as a long-term journey. And the reason I like to say that is because what if you gave someone like 6 weeks in order to become that person, in order to lose the weight, in order to do all that kind of stuff? What's going to happen is that they're going to get pressured. I got to do this, I got to do that, and everything's got to be perfect. As opposed to, what if you gave yourself like a 2-year timeline and said, hey, I'm going to do this, and slowly but surely, I'm going to move towards that specific idealization, but I'm going to give myself time to do this. What happens in that sense, when you give yourself a longer time horizon, is you give yourself time to make mistakes. You give yourself time to do sustainable things, like even like incorporating your favorite foods. Like, it will make the weight loss a little bit slower. But what's going to happen at the end when you've lost all the weight is that you actually have a diet that you can sustain for the rest of your life because you're incorporating the foods that you love.
Yeah, it's a lifestyle. You don't want to come off of it.
So people overestimate what they can do in the span of 6 to 12 weeks. To me, that's just a launch. Like, it takes 80% of energy to like launch a rocket to space. And that's the whole concept of like the first 6 to 12 weeks. The real juice actually comes from giving yourself the long time horizon to say, hey, what's up? I'm going to treat this like a 2-year journey. And it doesn't mean that I'll hit my goal in 2 years. It just means that I'm going to take the pressure off. And I'm going to allow myself to figure out what actually works for me when it comes to all of this stuff. For some people, it could be like, I don't like to have carbs. You know what I mean? Like, some people go to that place and they're like, you know what? I'm actually good. I don't have to have carbs for the rest of my life. I came to this realization. That's fine. For some people, it could be like, you know what? I like to have chocolate every day. And I want to find a way in which I can moderate that and have one a day in a way that fits my lifestyle. But you can't do that in 6 weeks. You have to do that over the course of time. And then that's where a true identity change comes from.
Oh, that's powerful. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And the long-term horizon. I think people really need to let that drop in. A lot can happen in 12 weeks. You know, yes. I like how you described it as the launch, that escape velocity. It takes a lot of energy to get a rocket off the ground. That said, it's a whole journey. It's going to go on.
So the biggest problem I find when people do that, they get amazing results, 12, 16 weeks, whatever it is, right?
Sure.
The biggest thing that I see with a lot of people is like, okay, I'm done.
Okay.
Ooh, no, 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 no.
Sure.
I'm good. I'm actually, no, I'm good. I have the habits, I have the behaviors. It's like, ooh, once, like, that's kind of like this like thing that perks up in me that I see so many times is like, It's great. I'm on good momentum. It's easy. And I'm just going to do this for the rest of my life. I actually like to say, no. Actually, the first 12 weeks, you got amazing results. You lost 30, 40 pounds off your body. Incredible. Now, this is actually where the real work begins. This is the aspect of maintaining. It's the aspect of maybe building some muscle if you've maybe lost some, like during that course. It's like people kind of get stuck in this mode of like fat loss, fat loss, fat loss. I'm just going to get leaner, leaner, leaner. And then what happens is that mentality becomes this curse where they're always trying to get as lean as possible. When you want to be doing things and say, hey, when is enough enough for me? And what do I have to do in order to maintain this level of enough? And for me, a lot of that times is it's actually building up the other behaviors, which is like building up muscle in a way where you're going to be able to support the metabolism. Maybe even after that, building up a cardio engine, you know, like to increase VO2 max if you're interested in longevity. But it always comes down to kind of like, what is my plan for after the plan is done? And that's what a lot of people lose.
I heard you talking about that, always continuing to like set the next goal, set the next mountaintop that you're ascending to keep yourself just progressing towards improvement. And there's so much there, Dan. I want to talk about a lot of people are interested in GLP-1s and how to do them the right way. And I think you and I can both look out into the world and see a lot of cautionary tales about certainly doing it the wrong way, over-relying on the medication, not eating correctly, not changing your habits, not doing the strength training, not doing a lot of what we've talked about today, that deeper identity shifting, all of it. You I saw this wonderful infographic you put together. It was the high-performance GLP-1 protocol, and there were, I think, 7 different steps. Can you just tell me why you put that together? And what would be the ideal environment for someone using a GLP-1? What would that look like?
So number one, when someone is using a GLP-1, I highly advise them to do it in conjunction with a professional. And I would actually add 2 professionals in there. Like one of them would be their medical professional. The other one would be a coach, whether it's a personal trainer or a health coach, whatever it is. You want people on your team, and hopefully like you can afford those things. And if you can't, I mean, like we have amazing AI coaches that are coming around that can fill that gap for you. So the very first one is get support, get accountability. Don't do this on your own, please. A lot of people are kind of like treating themselves as their own science experiment, and they don't have to do that. Like we have a lot of evidence on like what works and what doesn't. And let's just say like the excitement is palpable with a lot of people. So they will just be like, all right, I'm going to start to dose this and I'm not going to do it with a professional. And I'm like, big mistake, please find a professional or find someone to lead you down this path. The very first one that we're going to be doing is, with the medical professional, we're finding out what the dosage is. I mean, that's like the very first one. It's like, what is the right dosage for you? Because there's like different dosages for different people. Like if someone is severely obese, as opposed to someone who wants to take this in order to either maintain or lose maybe just like a little bit of weight, there's actually like a sliding scale of like dosages, and you want to find the right one for yourself, because that's where a lot of like these side effects come from. And that's where the aspect of like getting professional help comes from as well.
Yeah. And just to insert one thing there, a lot of times it can have to do with like what a medical professional could see in your blood work, how much insulin resistance you have, if you're pre-diabetic. People, the deeper you are, like in kind of the red, that spectrum, you might need a little more.
Yeah. And what we want to, I always like to go with intention first, which is what we did at the beginning of this call. I love like just being very intentional about everything. So when we're going into this process and we're saying, hey, what's up? I'm going to be taking this GLP-1 and I'm going to be doing this. The intention that you want to set is going to be one that's going to be fulfilling for yourself, whatever that is. The intention that I would set for my clients is, number one, I'm going to use this as a window. Like it's like a metabolic and a psychological window to get to the goal that I'm after and the person I'm trying to become. And also, along with that, I have to just understand that I don't want to be taking this for the rest of my life. So yes. What exactly? Yeah.
It's thank like, you.
Yeah. I hear so much purported about like, oh, yeah, everyone's just going to be on the GLP-1, 50% of people. And like, I'm just like, no.
Yeah.
Like, don't. Because there is a way, there is a path out of this. There is a path where you don't have to be taking medications. And also something that we're seeing with like the side effects with GLP-1s is like the longer you take it, the more that we're kind of like increasing that risk for side effects as we get deeper into the medication. So there should have to be an exit plan. Like what does your life look like without taking a GLP-1? Because that should be a part of that. So intention first. Then we want to get into the nitty gritty. We're not going to be eating a lot of food. We're actually going to be not even having any appetite. What people don't realize on these GLP-1s is actually the aspect of like how much they were thinking about food in the first place. That's completely gone. So they're going to have like almost let's just say they won't have like zero interest in food, but they're going to have a significantly turned down desire for food itself. So what do we have to do? We have to make sure that we set up the parameters to make sure that they are getting fed in a way that is not going to be detrimental to their health. So number one thing that we do with our clients is number one, nutritional architecture. What are the times of which we're eating? Because we're going to be sticking to these times regardless if we're on a GLP-1 or not. So if you eat like breakfast, lunch, and dinner, we want to be able to say that, hey, we're going to be eating at these times pre and post GLP-1. And we want to find out what these great times for you are going to be based on your lifestyle. Then we get into the quality of foods itself. I like to say like 80% of the foods that you eat are going to come from whole, single ingredient, nutrient dense sources, which if you're on a GLP-1, it becomes a little bit harder to eat these things because of the way it makes you feel.
Yeah. And so, that might be because they might be a little dose too high. Just push back a little bit. Like if your hunger comes completely offline, that might be an indicator that you're on too high of a dose.
Exactly. So we have to just like set these, like I call them guardrails to protect us, right? So 80% of our foods come from single ingredient, whole, nutrient dense sources. I would invite the tool of actually tracking what you're eating just to get a baseline and understand like how much food we're putting into our bodies. Then afterwards, 20% of that ratio is like, hey, invite some of your favorite foods into that calorie ratio.
Oh, okay? I love that. Yes.
Yeah, and don't do this like just on the weekends and treat it like a cheat day. Like do this like regularly, every day, right? Like it's okay. Your diet does not have to be perfect for you to be healthy. Absolutely not. So we set up the nutritional architecture first, and actually a big part of that is going to be protein. So we set a floor and a ceiling, right? So the floor is always going to be 0.8 grams of their current body weight. Their ceiling is going to be 1 gram per pound of body weight for protein. It could be 1 gram per pound of goal body weight as well. But something that we want to do, especially on the GLP-1, is make sure that we're retaining as much muscle as humanly possible. That is the number one thing. Actually, that's probably like number 1A of the thing that we're trying to fix. The other thing that we're trying to make sure of is that we're getting the right nutrients, whether that be from whole, single ingredient, nutrient dense foods or from supplementation, which I'll get into in a second.
Oh, I want to hear all about that. Yes.
Yes. So the next part is going to be weight training.
Okay.
This is mandatory.
Yeah.
It is mandatory that if you are on a GLP-1, there should be some form of resistance training. It doesn't mean that you have to hit the gym. It doesn't mean that you have to like go and work out in front of a bunch of strangers and go through that entire experience. It doesn't mean that. But what it does mean is that 2 to 3 times per week, you're doing some form of progressive resistance training, whether that be with your body weight, whether that be with weights. If you want to get a personal trainer, that's awesome. They can keep you accountable. But we need to give our muscles the signal that, hey, what's up? We still need you. Because when we are eating, let's just say like we're in a bigger calorie deficit than usual, what's going to happen is that the body's going to look at it and be like, okay, what sources of energy can I actually extract from? And muscle is going to be one of those. And I tell people this all the time. It's like losing or actually gaining muscle is like 5 times harder than trying to lose weight. Because the process is so much slower. So if they lose, let's call it like 2 to 3, 4 pounds of muscle while they're trying to lose weight, it could be lean. I mean, if they're doing the DEXA, it could be a lean mass, but that could be misconstrued. But if they're losing even like 2 pounds of muscle, what we know from the evidence is that it's going to take around like 2 to maybe sometimes 4 months to get that muscle back. So we have to make sure that we are giving our bodies the actual response to say, hey, what's up? I need to keep my muscle.
Yeah.
And also, when we're doing these workouts, tactically, when we're advising our high performers, we're actually not going into like these like hour-long workouts at all. Like, we're not telling people, hey, what's up? You got to hit the gym. You got to do all this volume just to keep your muscle. We actually find with the calorie deficit, especially a severe one that they may be on with the GLP-1, is we actually reduce the volume to around what, let's just say two-thirds of what they would normally be doing inside the gym. We have this thing called the 2X method, which is like the 2X workout method. And it goes like this, which is number one, we are hitting up each major muscle group at least 2 times per week, because this is a primary driver, a great driver of muscle hypertrophy. It gives that signal to the body to say, hey, what's up? We need this. The other thing that we are doing with the 2X method is we're doing 2 sets, and we're taking these sets as close to failure as possible. Between these 2 sets, it's going to be a full body workout. You're going to have 3 minutes of rest in between. You're not doing a circuit. You're not trying to like get through these as fast as possible. Actually, if you do it properly, you're going to get in and out of the gym in like 30 minutes. It's like super quick.
That's so doable.
It's so doable. It's so doable. And also it helps people keep their muscle. Like, we find that when people have like higher volume types of workout programs, what happens is that every time they hit the gym, it becomes almost like this negotiation, because there's this vast workout that's just sitting right in front of them. They know they're going to be tired. They know that mentally they're going to be exhausted. But when they have this 30-minute workout that they can do that's going to help them keep muscle, it takes the pressure off. Oh, okay, I'm going to do this 30 minutes. I'm going to rest between my sets. I'm going to be in and out and about, you know, whatever. And it just takes like that pressure, that mental exhaustion away from that particular aspect of the GLP-1 protocol. The other one is going to be movement. For myself, we want to incorporate at least 7,000 steps per day.
Oh, I love that. Walking. So
walking.
Important. Yeah.
No running. No running.
No
please.
Running. And people can start with walking. A lot of times if you've been really, you haven't been doing anything, walking is a good place to start, right?
Yes. I actually find it to be the most underrated exercise on the planet. And if people love running and they love cardio and doing all that kind of stuff, like, by all means, go about and do it. Do what you love. But most people, when they go into a weight loss phase, they're like, oh, I got to do cardio. I got to be on the treadmill. Like, no. They actually, you just have to find ways to walk that fit your lifestyle and that don't feel like you're actually walking.
Yeah.
So a lot of things that I love to do is because we work with like a lot of entrepreneur clients, these guys are, set in a lot of meetings. I'm just like, yo, what's up? It's summertime. Take those meetings outside, put your video off of Zoom and whatever, and just like walk around and have that meeting. And I kid you not, like, people are getting an extra like 4,000 to 5,000 steps just by turning their meetings into walking meetings. I personally, for myself, get a walking treadmill. I do this for like the wintertime when it's like super cold. I don't want to go outside, but still I do walking meetings on there. I do a lot of like, I call it kind of like shallow work, like answering emails and whatever while I'm actually walking. And the reason I say to walk is because subconsciously what happens in our brains when we start to lose weight is that our brains start to slow us down physically. So we have this thing called non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is like just a fancy way of saying the more you move, the more you burn fat, right? What happens in our brains is that because we're losing so much weight, our bodies tend to make us a little bit more lazy. So we want to sit on the couch more. We want to chill out. But what we don't realize about walking is it does a couple of things aside from weight loss that actually assist in weight loss. Number one is it actually helps you regulate your blood sugar swings a lot more efficiently. That's walking. Like number one. That's what, walking, especially after a meal. It helps us like with the blood sugar swings. It helps us kind of get over any kind of energy deficits that we may feel in the middle of the day, which is what a lot of people feel. That's when the second coffee or third coffee comes in. So it turns our bodies into this like glucose sink, and it kind of like helps us regulate these spikes that would normally cause us to get cravings or feel like we're low energy. The second thing it does is it helps us relieve a ton of stress, a ton. When we're actually running, we're kind of increasing cortisol because we're kind of pushing ourselves. We're like, I just want to push myself. I want to sweat. I want to see like how far I can take this. When it comes to walking, you are essentially just being there with nature, with your own thoughts. If you want to bring a phone and you want to do your podcast, cool. But what we find is that is one of the best stress relieving activities, especially for people who consider themselves to be high performers and who are these type A individuals. You need some form of stress mitigation. A lot of these people are just like going from like one stress throughout their entire day. Then they go back home and see their family. And then they have like all this other stress that they haven't allowed themselves to mitigate. So we find that walking, especially with walking like 7,000 steps, which is about 3,000 more than what the average person gets. It just allows you to kind of mitigate and also deregulate this stress, to allow yourself to like just chill. And that's one of the most important things. And also it increases your energy.
Yeah, it balances your nervous system too, that bilateral stimulation.
Absolutely. And you know, if you're walking in the forest, it's kind of like stress release on steroids. It's like you're able to see, but I'm in BC right now and it's all smoky because of all the wildfires. So I'm not doing any walking outside. I'm just kind of stepping in my house a little bit. But still, it's like the more steps that you get throughout the day, the more that you're going to realize that you're not, that is going to be the level of stress that you incur, and you will experience a lot less stress. And actually, stress is what causes a lot of people to want to go eat in the first place. We want to exhaust the mind or exhaust the body so we can actually control how our minds work.
Oh, gosh. Keep going. This is it's such a beautiful holistic approach to GLP-1s, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. And then we'll get into sleep. And this might seem controversial, but when it comes to sleep, this is actually the last thing that we work on with people. This is the last thing, especially with entrepreneurs. And the reason I say it's the last thing that we work on, and it all depends on what their main bottleneck is. But it's the last thing that we work on because we find that it's actually the most difficult to routinize, and it's the most difficult to create behaviors around, because a lot of people are kind of like sunk into what they do before sleep, which, you know, adds or detracts away from their goals. So when it comes to sleep, we want to focus more so on things that we can do that would make sleep, make quality sleep evergreen without you even having to think about it in the first place. So the very first one we're working on is going to be environment. So what is your sleep environment like? I know for myself, like if I sleep with my wife in the same bed, if we share covers, I'm not going to have the best sleep. I am absolutely not going to have the best sleep. So I have my weighted blanket. She has her own blanket. We're able to sleep in the same bed, and I'm able to get an amazing sleep as a result of just this one little change in my environment. The other thing is going to be blackout shades. You could take this step for, or actually take it a step further and get these little black stickers that will go over these LED lights inside of your room, and to just make sure that we're not getting any kind of like artificial light exposure while we're sleeping. The other thing with the environment is going to be what kind of bed you're using. I mean, do you need a bed cooler? Do you run hot? Do you run cold? We want to be able to create an environment that is going to make great sleep evergreen by the time you put your head on the pillow. So that's like environment. The next one is going to be routine. And a lot of people think routines are kind of like these convoluted, you know, 20-step formulas, but they're not. It's really just like, what are like the top one to two, three things that you're going to do before you go to sleep? That is almost going to trigger your brain to understanding that, hey, it's actually time to chill out. So what I love is the fact that our bodies are machines. And our machines work with triggers, especially like this machine right here, which is our brain. So when we have specific actions that we take in our routine that will trigger to our brain that it's time to go to sleep, the more our brains and our bodies will correlate with relaxing at that time. So there are a couple of things that you could do in your routine. I'll share my routine, but everyone else is different. So at 9 o'clock, I'm putting my blue light blockers on because I'm still watching TV. Yes, I still watch TV. I love watching TV, all that kind of stuff. So I'm not like biohacker, 1000, but yeah, I still watch TV. So I put on my blue light blockers because I don't want any of that blue light getting into my eyes. And also it acts as this trigger to say, hey, what's up, nervous system? It's time to chill out. Around 2 hours before I go to sleep, I take the sleep tea, where it's like chamomile tea with 5 to 10 grams of glycine. And we'll talk about supplements like right after this. But that is, to me, one of the best ways I've found to not only get myself to sleep, but also to relax my body so I can stay asleep. Also, it acts as a trigger as well. It's like if I take that tea, my body's like, okay, cool. 2 hours before I go to sleep, time to go to sleep soon. The next thing with routine, it can go so many ways, but I like to read a book, a fiction book, right before I go to sleep. If the fiction book is really good, then probably not a great, habit, but like for me, reading a fiction book right before I go to sleep is enough to turn my brain off. And also, again, it acts as this trigger to tell my brain, hey, we got to go to sleep. So find whatever one of those three steps are for you, and then make sure that you are abiding by it. And actually, one more thing in the routine.
Yes.
Highly recommend that if you really want to improve the quality of your sleep, then like the timing of your foods matters. So the reason I put my last meal at 6 is because it's around like 4 hours before I go to sleep. And I know because I've tested it with like sleep trackers and everything, I know that when I give myself that time, I have an amazing sleep and I'm able to stay asleep for the rest of the night. So part of that routine would be like, when is your last meal? And then we get into timing, and timing is very simple. It's like, when do you wake up? When do you go to sleep? The more that we can make these things similar to each other, whether it's the weekday and the weekends, it really is more important than how many hours you're getting of sleep. When your body knows when it's supposed to sleep and when it's supposed to be awake, that is actually one of the best indicators of good sleep hygiene. The other thing with timing is like, how many hours do you need? So everyone correlates with a different amount of hours. So very rarely do people correlate with like 6 hours. It's very rare. There's some people that like to be like, oh, I can do it. But it's like, no, you're probably not getting enough sleep for yourself. But there's like this one little, I think it's like a genetic mutation that allows people to sleep anywhere between 4 to 6 hours. Cool. There's only a very small percentage of people who can do that. Usually it's around 7 to 9 hours. Okay. And the way in which I like to think about timing is there is a amount of time that it takes for you to go to sleep. You have to factor that in. So when people think they're getting like, they're going to sleep and they're sleeping from 11 to 7 a.m., they think they're getting 8 hours of sleep, when the reality is they're probably getting close to around 7 to 7.5 because of the time it takes them to go to sleep, right? So we just want to factor in, how much hours do I need in order for me to perform at my best? The last part is going to be the part that usually people want to go with first, which is going to be the supplementation.
Yeah.
They always want to go with supplementation. But for me, it's like supplements should actually supplement everything that we're doing on the foundational
basis. That's what it's called. It's a supplement. It adds to something.
Exactly.
The full entree, ladies and gentlemen.
So let's just say like before getting into supplementation, when we do specific tests with our clients, we want to actually do a nutrient panel for them. I mean, like, I think it's a pretty cheap test.
Nutrient panels. Which one do you suggest?
I just asked my GP for like a basic nutrient panel. I want to get my vitamin D and my magnesium. That's probably the two.
And B vitamins.
Sorry, B12 is going to be a huge one too, right? Yeah. So I want to see exactly what I'm deficient in, and that's going to inform me of the supplements that I would need, or if I can actually shore this up with food, then I'm going to use that as well, right?
Sure.
So. Even though I'm going to give like a supplement list that is recommended for people to go, that we would recommend for people who are on the GLP-1, it doesn't mean that everyone should be taking this who's on the GLP-1, because you want to be able to use a nutrient panel to see what you're deficient in.
Yeah.
So the very first one is, for me, I see 75% of people that come into my practice, they're deficient in vitamin D.
Sure.
And that's a huge one.
It's so big. It acts like a hormone in the body.
It does. Like, just from, and what people don't realize about vitamin D, especially like if there are people of different cultures that are watching this, mm-hmm. is that people of different culture will respond to a amount of vitamin D that could be more or could be needed in terms of less. So I'll use an example of one of my friends. His name is UJ. He came from India. He moved over to Toronto from India, and he checked his vitamin D levels and they were deficient. So he just did the normal dose of like 6,000 IU. And then he checked his vitamin D levels again, and they didn't move an inch, like they didn't move one inch. But because he was of darker descent, because he came from India, he actually needed to load up on like super physiological levels of vitamin D in order to get the proper amount. So when we're looking at vitamin D, it's not like a one size fits all. We're looking at it from like, okay, what kind of culture are you? How much do you need? How much are you deficient in? And actually with vitamin D, that's one thing that we find deficient in, again, like 75% of people. It's actually the one, I call it like a hormone, because it kind of is. It's like, sure, the one hormone that people are deficient in, or that people are like dysregulated in. So vitamin D is going to be the first one. The second one is going to be creatine monohydrate. And the reason I say creatine monohydrate is because of two things. Number one, when you're on a deficit, you want to be able to retain muscle as much as possible. So when you're on creatine monohydrate, one of the key things that it does when you get 5 grams of that, it's going to allow you a better chance of keeping that muscle and also maintaining strength and power.
Quick question on creatine, and I'm also watching the time. I know you're super busy and I want to get you out of here out of time, but just creatine, some people, when they take it, it makes their stomach a little upset. Is there some hack for better tolerating it?
Yes. I would actually say, look at how you're taking it. If you're taking it on an empty stomach or you're taking it with a full stomach, I would look at the variables of which you're taking it first. Mm-hmm. So I would also look at the quality of brand that you're taking as well, because a lot of creatine brands, they have these fillers, which could act as sensitivities to people's guts when they're taking it in.
You don't know what you're getting.
Yeah, you don't know. I mean, like, you just want creatine monohydrate. That's when you're looking at the ingredient label. Yeah, that's all you want.
But unless it's lab tested, you don't really know if that's all you're getting. Do you have a brand you like?
I absolutely. Okay, so I'll use the type of creatine, which is in multiple brands, which is called Crea Pure. Crea Pure is in brands like Thorne, and brands like Momentous, and brands like Create. And with Crea Pure, you know that you're getting the gold standard of creatine without any of those fillers whatsoever. And we're just aiming for about 5 grams we're aiming for 5 grams a day of that.
And
the other ones that were,
take that every day or only on the days when you train?
Take it every day.
Every day.
So creatine saturates over the course of time. Okay. So it's not like you take creatine and automatically your workout's going to be like, you know, the bomb diggity. It's like you take creatine and you actually take that for about 7 to 14 days. That saturates in your body. And that saturation is what allows for the greater hypertrophy, for the greater strength gains. But we have to allow that to happen. And that only happens when we're taking it consistently. I'm going to go through the other ones super quick right now, because we are running out of time. So next one is going to be omega-3s, making sure that we're getting some form of omega-3s to fight inflammation, to actually be a benefit for our joints as well. The other one is going to be a multivitamin because of nutrient insurance. We just want to make sure that we are getting the right amount of nutrients into our bodies. The other one's going to be B12. So we find that with a lot of people, when they are on GLP-1s, the B vitamins are actually missing. And this can actually cause a lot of downstream mood issues, a lot of like energy issues. The last one is going to be psyllium husk. So because of the fact that, you know, let's just say like people, we talked about this where they may be taking too much of a GLP-1 and that may be making their entire idea of like food just like not digestible for them. But for the vast majority of people, like 90 to 95% of anyone who's on the GLP-1 or not, they are highly deficient in fiber. So getting anywhere between 25 to 35 grams of fiber, whether that be through the foods and also a combination of supplementation, that will probably get you into the spot where you're going to be regular, but also it's going to be beneficial for your gut health as well.
Yeah, Dan, thank you so much. This is just so valuable. I love talking with you. What are you most excited about in the next 18 months? Where can people find you? Tell us more.
So I'm really excited about GLP-1s because I do believe that they are going to help millions of people, millions and millions of people fix the one area of their life that they felt that they were not able to fix. So I'm really a fan of these medications in the right context. And I'm glad that we're having this conversation. The next one is going to be, for me, it's actually the ability to use artificial intelligence, AI, to aggregate large swaths of data. So I find that from a bio-individuality standpoint, when we can give AI all of the information that we have about ourselves, whether it's genetic testing, whether it's blood work, whether it's DEXA scans, all this stuff, Strava, like whatever it is, we can aggregate this data and get hyper-personalized recommendations based on what we should be doing for our bodies. So for me, it's like AI is just, it's probably the worst it's ever going to be. I am highly into getting some form of accountability while you're doing this. I think AI coaching is fantastic. I also think AI coaching plus human coaching combined together is going to be not just fantastic. I actually find that to be the gold standard for transformation.
Wow.
When someone is actually getting, so AI to me, AI coaching to me is like helping you in kind of like the go-betweens between you and your coach, between you and your human coach, but the human coach, that's actually someone that you respect. That's actually someone that can make sense of all the things that AI is telling you. And that's actually someone that you can trust and someone that who has a human face that can hold you accountable to what you said you're going to do and also work you through all the emotional obstacles and pitfalls that usually happen as a result of going through a process like this.
Yeah.
So those are like the top two things I'm super excited about. If people want to find me, they can just search Dan Goh anywhere, go on Google, search for that. And just in general, it's like I am in support of anyone that is doing anything to improve their lives, whether they're on medications or whether they're not on medications, like whatever it is. So I'm in support.
Nice. Excellent. Well, all of your information will be in the show notes. Dan, just thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. This has been so valuable. You're amazing. Yeah. God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for having me on. And I'll say this, like, I actually don't take a lot of podcast interviews, but I had to go on this one. I had to, because I see this as being the next frontier with medical technology and also with health transformation. And I'm glad that you're leading from the front and doing that.
Thank you so much. That's awesome. All right. Well, say goodbye for now. Like we do it, like we do it, like we do it, like we do it, like we do it.